Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Philosophers often speculate about possible worlds, ways that things could be.
But some of them also believe in impossible worlds, ways that things couldn't be.
Alice laughed.
There's no use trying,
she said.
One can't believe in possible things.
I dare say you haven't had much practice,
said the Queen.
When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast.
The round square, the square circle, is there somewhere they exist?
If you try to describe an impossibility, aren't you just going to contradict yourself?
I think the world we live in, our world, is impossible.
Our guest is Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University.
That's impossible.
That's impossible.
That's impossible.
That's impossible.
It's impossible.
It's impossible, I'm afraid.
Impossible worlds. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This year, it's been everything from cancel culture to contradictions, from wise women to weird ones.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click Support Us at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life with a subscription to our library of nearly 600 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Could there be such a thing as an impossible world?
If there were, could we even imagine it?
Would contradictions suddenly become true?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about impossible worlds.
Impossible worlds. You know, that always seemed like a contradiction in terms to me. I totally get it about possible worlds. Like, there's a world out there where I teach philosophy and you teach French.
Ah, oui.
C'est ça, exactement. But okay, that's possible worlds, right? Surely there isn't a world in which you do teach French and you don't teach French. That's impossible.
Well, wait, you accept that there's, you know, a possible world where I have 3 heads, right?
Well, okay, yeah.
Well, that's already pretty weird. Why not also think there's a world where I both do teach French and don't teach French?
Well, the problem isn't that it's weird. It's that it's contradictory. It violates the laws of logic. So that world can't exist.
Wait. According to that impossible world, contradictions are true. You know, that's why it's impossible. I said that contradictions are true in impossible world. I don't think they're true in real life.
Oh, you're breaking my brain here, Ray. If something is contradictory, how can it be true anywhere? I mean, you can't be older than your mother, wherever you are, even if you move to Mars.
But impossible worlds aren't places you can visit. They're more like stories. And stories can contradict themselves.
Okay, now you're moving to my terrain. I love stories, and I love contradictory stories. One of my favorite examples is the Sherlock Holmes stories, where Watson sometimes has a war wound on his leg and sometimes doesn't. I love that.
So if you love that, why don't you love impossible worlds? You've just given an example of one. The world of Conan Doyle's fiction. It's here, it's impossible, get used to it.
But the thing is, there's no world of Conan Doyle's fiction. There are just multiple possible worlds that Conan Doyle kind of confused with each other. He just forgot that he originally gave Watson a war wound in his shoulder instead of his leg.
Okay, maybe that works for the Sherlock Holmes stories, but you can also tell stories that are inconsistent on purpose. Just think about those fantastic drawings by M.C. Escher, like the one where people keep going up and up and up a staircase, and then they end up exactly where they started.
That's one of my favorite pictures ever. But again, I'm not sure it depicts an impossible world. I mean, couldn't we say it's 2 possible worlds sandwiched together? Like, if you cover up either half of the picture, all you see is people going up. It's only when you put those 2 halves together that they don't make sense.
Yeah, Josh, you can get a possible world if you cover up half the picture. But the point is to look at the whole picture. That's where there's an impossible world. Besides, not all impossible fictions are so easy to separate into parts like that. Just think about Tamar Gendler's Tower of Goldbach story.
Oh, right. That's the one about God punishing mathematicians when they prove that every even number is the sum of two primes. God makes it so that 12 is suddenly no longer the sum of 5 plus 7.
Right. But he offers to relent if the mathematicians can find 12 virtuous people. And they manage to find 5 from one village and 7 from another, but they can't put them together to make 12.
It's so good. It's such a great story. But I regret to say, Ray, I don't think it proves your point. The fact is, I can't imagine that world. I can't imagine the world of the Tower of Goldbach, a world where 5 plus 7 is not equal to 12. In fact, that's one reason I love the story so much.
Well, maybe our guest will help you to imagine it. It's Koji Tanaka, a philosopher of logic from the Australian National University.
In the meantime, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to think about the impossible worlds of patients with dementia. She files this report.
Last I can see the purpose of my life, Bartleby, and I'm content.
In Herman Melville's short story, Bartleby, we meet a clerk who one day refuses to do any new tasks. He says repeatedly, "I would prefer not to."
My mission in this world, Bartleby, is to provide you with office space for as long as you may choose to remain.
Fiction has the luxury to play with reality.
Dasha Kipper, a clinical psychologist, says the hapless narrator and his desperate and futile efforts remind her of caregiving for patients with dementia.
Instinctually, viscerally, I always thought, my mind would always flash on some of the literature that I read, that I think that really captured the absurdity and the banality of being a caregiver.
Kipper says caregivers are navigating these impossible worlds where they can't count on memory, logic, or continuity. She writes about that in her book, Travelers to Unimaginable Lands, Stories of Dementia, the Caregiver, and the Human Brain.
It's almost like a philosophical thought experiment because everything that the human mind needs that make it possible for us to sustain human relationships is now slowly being taken away by this disease.
And she's seen how this plays out. When Kipper was 25, she moved in to care for a 98-year-old Holocaust survivor in the first stages of Alzheimer's disease.
What really struck me as I was taking care of him was how much my own brain was kind of unraveling.
Kipper also watched how the man's son would have the same argument with his dad over and over.
I would see his son going into the, you know, anger, argument, guilt, anger, argument, guilt.
Even knowing about his father's disease, the son would return to the familiar routine and the same family dynamics. In Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, the family also falls back to their usual ways in spite of the main character Gregor's pretty dramatic transformation.
Gregor Samsa awoke one morning to discover that he had been transformed into a giant cockroach.
On the one hand, everything changed when their son transformed into a bug. And on the other hand, absolutely nothing changed. And I found that to be so emblematic of families with dementia.
In another example from Kipper's book, a husband begins to think that at certain moments, his wife, Elizabeth, is no longer his wife, but an intruder.
She would say, "No, I'm your wife." She'd give him all this evidence. And he would throw her out of the house. He'd become very hostile and defensive. And Elizabeth was really ashamed later on to say how long it took her to stop arguing.
Even when caregivers stop arguing against impossible worlds, they can still feel irrational emotions. Kipper points to another example where a husband sees his wife having conversations with book jackets, sharing her childhood in Vienna with Marcel Proust. He would be envious of Thomas Mann.
He was very protective of his wife's inner world. And when he would ask about her world or try to be included in it, and he did this gently, she would get very angry with him, like he was intruding and he should really mind his own business.
We're biological creatures with social needs that are hard to push aside. Kipper says we expect caregivers to feel sadness, but we rarely acknowledge or see how their own brains are being tormented in the process too.
This disease demands so much of our brain that I really believe we're not always capable of. The barriers are so big, and those barriers are not just logistic. They're also neurological.
Dasha Kipper says it's a mistake to look at the disease in a vacuum, where one brain has deficits and the other is perfectly healthy, reasonable, and capable. When one person lives in an impossible world, the people close by dip into it too. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about impossible worlds.
We're joined now by Koji Tanaka. He's an ARC Future Fellow at the Australian National University in Canberra and co-author of Two Kinds of Logical Impossibility. Koji, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
So Koji, you've been writing about impossible worlds for some time now. How did you first get interested in them? Was it from reading Lewis Carroll as a kid?
Well, I was born in Japan, so I'm a Japanese. And as a typical Japanese, I'm a Buddhist. I was raised as a Buddhist. So after studying philosophy in Australia, naturally, I got interested in learning about Buddhist philosophy. And maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I was reading one of the passages of a Buddhist text. And I realized that maybe this text is dealing with logical impossibility. So that's how I got interested in thinking about impossibility.
So Koji, Josh and I were arguing earlier about whether there's any such thing as an impossible world. I think there is, and Josh thinks there isn't. Which of us is right?
I think you are right, Ray. I think impossible worlds do exist because I think the world we live in, our world, is impossible.
Wait, our world our world is impossible? That's a big headline. why is our world impossible?
Yeah. So I do think the world we live in does exist, and therefore I do think that impossible worlds do exist.
Right, so I'm not worried about the part where it exists. I'm worried about the part where it's impossible. Why is it impossible?
Well, so I think this depends on how you define impossibility. So there are maybe 3 or 4 different ways of defining impossibility. And I think if you understand in the way that I understand it, then the world we live in comes out to be impossible.
So what is your understanding of impossible?
So the way that I understand impossibility is that if you think about, just to give you a simple picture of what a world is, let's say a world consists of facts. They just simply basically represent, they tell you what happens at the world. And then there are laws, and the laws tell you what have to happen at the world.
So a fact would be like, I'm talking to Koji right now about impossible worlds.
That's right, yeah. Things which are true in that world or at that world.
And a law would be like, if I talk to Koji and I press the right buttons on the radio soundboard, then the broadcast will go out to all of our listeners.
That's right. Or if you drop a pen in midair, it's ought to drop to the floor or something of that kind. So a law essentially tells you what ought to happen, and facts, I guess, are the things which do happen. And I understand impossibility to be a discrepancy between the two. So the facts somehow basically disobey what ought to happen. And I understand impossibility to be this discrepancy between the two.
So impossible worlds are kind of worlds with law breaking in them. Is that right?
That's right, yes. And I do think that the world that we live in is a world like that.
It's a renegade world. But as I understand it, there are these different kinds of impossibility, right? Physical impossibility, an animal that talks. Metaphysical impossibility, something like time travel maybe. And then logical impossibility, where it's the kind of thing Ray and I were talking about earlier, the Tower of Goldbach, 7 plus 5 equals 12 and doesn't equal 12. Which is the one we should focus on for the, you know, for the purposes of our conversation?
So in the literature on impossible worlds, people do focus on logical impossibility, but the way I understand impossibility can be generalized. So the way that I understand it, it doesn't really matter whether I'm talking about logical impossibility or physical impossibility, because what matters for me is the discrepancy between laws and facts or what happens. So if what happens essentially goes against what ought to happen, doesn't matter what kind of laws we are talking about, then it is impossible. So my account is generalizable, whereas most accounts aren't.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about impossible worlds with Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University.
Do you enjoy impossible stories? Do you try to make them make sense? or do you revel in their paradoxes?
In Search of the Round Square, along with your comments and questions, When Philosophy Talk continues. Is it really impossible for there to be a world where 2 plus 2 equals 5? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about impossible worlds with Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University.
Got possible questions about the impossible? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and imagine the possibilities in our library of nearly 600 episodes.
So, Koji, earlier you were telling us that our world, our actual world, is an impossible world, and that it's an impossible world because the facts kind of break the laws. What are the law-breaking facts that you'd like to point us to?
So, I do believe in true contradictions, and that means that the world we live in do contain contradictions. And so, for example, the sentence like what is called the liar sentence, which says that this very sentence that I'm uttering is not true. And I do think that sentences like that are both true and false. So I do think that they are contradictions. Or our movements do realize contradictory states. Now, I don't have any new arguments to show that they are contradictory. But what I do think is that what this entails is that the world we live in is impossible.
I love that. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a literature guy, but I love the idea that we're already living in an impossible world. I mean, I feel like Borges said it best. He said, you know, the collective have dreamt the world, but we've allowed there to be in it crevices of unreason, which tell us it's false. And yet he points to Zeno's paradoxes. He points to some stuff in Kant. I mean, for example, that the world both kind of has a beginning and kind of doesn't have a beginning. But we could think of, you know, paradoxes of infinity. We could think of quantum physics. Something can be a wave and a particle. The entanglement, things can be apart and together. It seems like the world is really weird. Why not? But I see Ray looking skeptical.
I don't know, Josh. Like, I will grant that Koji is right that there are true contradictions, which not everybody is willing to grant. But if there are true contradictions, what kind of laws of logic could there be that forbid those contradictions? Like, if the world doesn't obey them, how can they be laws of logic?
So if you believe in true contradictions, then you probably want to be so-called a paraconsistent logician. And what that means is that if there is a contradiction, it does not mean that everything is true. So most logicians do think that if there is a contradiction, if there were a contradiction, anything would be true. Now, I reject that as a paraconsistent logician. However, being a paraconsistent logician also means that I believe in the law of non-contradiction. So the law of non-contradictions says that every contradiction is false or every contradiction is not true. But if there were a true contradiction, then what that means is that the negation of a contradiction may not be true, even though the law of non-contradiction is valid, is a valid rule of logic. So what that means is that if there was a true contradiction, that confirms the law of non-contradiction as well as that disobeys the law. So that's why I think that the actual world, the world we live in, is impossible.
Okay, wow. I see how you get there. I'm curious also about other impossible worlds. So even if somebody is not a paraconsistent logician, they probably think, maybe the actual world is a possible world, but there are other impossible worlds. So why would such a person believe in impossible worlds? Like, what other reasons are there besides the actual world is impossible?
Right. So even though you may not think that our world, the world we live in, is contradictory, I can imagine a world could be contradictory. So for example, I can imagine a world where, you know, this may be a controversial issue, but 2 plus 2 is 5. At the same time, it is 4 as well. or you know, they, you might think of a fictional world where something like that was the case. And then, depending on what laws of logic you have in mind, that fact, that the contradictory fact, may disobey the law that that are operating at the world. So if you can imagine a world like that, then and according to my account, that is an impossible world.
Okay, so that's a pretty good rule of thumb, right? If I can imagine it, then that's an impossible world that, as it were, exists. But can we imagine them? That's something I've thought quite a lot about. I don't know where I stand on that. I mean, I love my fictional worlds that kind of don't add up. Like, I mean, I love Magritte, for example, right? And in Magritte's incredible paintings, you have, you know, a painting where it's both day and night at the same time. You have a painting where there's a rock just hanging in the air, a huge rock, right? You have a bird made up of sky, all these things that are impossible. But am I really imagining that world? Or am I doing something else? You know, for example, am I imagining different pieces, but not putting them together. So the full force of the contradiction doesn't really hit me. Like, let's say I'm trying to imagine that 2 + 2 = 5 world. But then in that world, you're telling the story. Once upon a time, there was a land where 2 + 2 = 5. And then one person came along and another person and two more people. I think I'm going to imagine 4 people. So are we really imagining those impossible worlds?
Well, I think so. Although that depends on what the how you understanding the laws that you think has to operate. Because according to my account, what counts as impossible is contingent on what laws you are talking about and what world you are talking about, what kind of world you are talking about. So if all of those, what happens at the world, do disobey the laws that you have in mind, then I do count that as impossible.
All right, so we've been talking quite a bit based on your account of what counts as an impossible world. And you mentioned that there were some others. Could you give us one of the alternatives?
So one popular way of understanding impossible worlds is that let's assume that there are certain laws operating at our world. Now, let's imagine a world where the laws are a bit different. So I'm not a physicist, but I believe it's true that in our world, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. But I think you can imagine a world where Usain Bolt can run faster than the speed of light. If anyone can break the speed of light, that I think would be Usain Bolt. And I think you can imagine a world like that. Now, you might then think that, well, that is an impossible world because the laws of physics must be different from our world. And you might count that as an impossible world. And that is one popular way of accounting for impossibility.
So you think worlds are impossible if they break their own laws. And you could think of a world as impossible if it rejects our laws. I guess you could also think a world is impossible if it breaks our laws. Is that different from rejecting our laws?
Yeah, so I think there are two different ways of understanding rejecting. One is going against. The other one is what I call being silent about the laws. So what if what happens there are silent about the laws, meaning that the basically the facts say, well, I don't care what you say, what you say ought to be the case. I'm not going to say anything about that. Then the facts are silent about the laws. And I think there are two ways in which that can happen. One is that the facts somehow disobey. The other one is that the facts are basically silent about the laws. And either way, somehow there's a discrepancy between the laws and what's happened. And when that happens, I think that's impossible.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about impossible worlds with Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University. And Koji, we've got a question from Daniel on our website. Daniel asks, are there unthinkable worlds? If so, how could they be known? What do you think, Koji?
Well, I think they are unthinkable worlds. It's just that they are at the same time thinkable. So you might think that's just got to be impossible. And if an unthinkable world is impossible, so be it. And because if there's an unthinkable world, I do think that has to be thinkable too, in order to think that is unthinkable. So yes, that's better be thinkable as well.
This makes me worried as somebody who likes impossible worlds, but maybe not as close to home as the actual world. I want to say, all right, there are lots of unthinkable worlds. There are lots of impossible worlds. If I have to admit that they're also thinkable and possible, as well as unthinkable and impossible, it looks like I've kind of brought the impossibility home to the actual world. Can I just leave the impossibility kind of further away in logical space without having to bring it home like that?
Well, I think my view is that you can't. Because what counts as impossible is contingent on a number of factors. So I don't think that you can just keep impossibilities to that fringe, because I think impossibility is basically among us. And it's maybe in the world we live in, or it's maybe a world which is kind of close to our world, but not quite our world. Or it could be farther away. But I don't think you can quarantine impossibility to the fringe of this space of possibilities and impossibilities.
We've been talking quite a bit about impossible worlds that are impossible because they violate laws of physics, or they violate laws of mathematics, 2 plus 2 equals 5, for example. But, you know, some of my favorites are ones that violate, if you want, the laws of fiction or the, I don't know, laws of ontological levels. And the kind of thing I'm talking about are fictions that break the fourth wall, fictions where you have characters saying, hey, I'm a fictional character. I mean, one of my favorites is Flann O'Brien's novel At Swim Two Birds, where the characters rebel against their author and drug him so that they can go about their lives undisturbed. But there's a bunch of other examples, right, where somehow, impossibly, the characters know that they're characters. The characters know the author. The characters can interact with the author, attack the author, apologize to the author. Is this would you call these impossible worlds? And is there anything particularly interesting about them that sets them apart from the kinds of cases of violation of physics?
Yeah, I never thought of impossibilities in fictions to be that interesting, I have to confess. So I haven't thought too much about impossibilities specifically in fictions. But I do think that there are impossibilities in fictions too. And in the case of where you essentially interacting with the authors, I think if you think that somehow the interactions have to go in a certain way, and if you think that what is happening there goes against that, then I do think that there's an impossibility there. So it's, I'm not sure that whether the impossibility is in the fiction itself or in the interactions with the fiction, but I'm happy to characterize that as impossibility.
Yeah, well, I guess the kind of thing I have in mind with that example is that there are these different levels of reality, and you've got a creator who invented a whole set of creatures that in principle don't know about the creator, right? And so that there's a kind of analogy there to the way in which some religious people think about the actual world, that there's a creator out there who created all of this. That creator knows everything about us, knows everything about our world, but we don't know that much about him or her or it. And so a similar thing applies in these self-reflexive fictions, in these fictions that break the fourth wall. The author's supposed to know about the characters, but the characters aren't supposed to. The author looks down into the fictional world. That's fine. But the characters looking up, that's a violation. And it's kind of a violation that reminds us of the situation that maybe we're in, right? Where we've been created, maybe. And so there's different levels of reality. And we can't violate the rules that apply to levels of reality. Do you think that makes sense? Or am I just overreading like the literature professor that I am?
No, I would buy into that. I might just, I probably should have wrote it down, and then I should publish that, actually.
Yeah, please, feel free.
So I'm wondering now whether you think that in addition to impossible worlds, there are possible worlds.
Yes, I do think there are possible worlds which are not impossible. But I guess I do think that which world, so if you have a set of worlds and kind of think of a world could be like this or a world could be like that, which counts as impossible and which counts as possible is contingent on what the perspective that I'm inhabiting. So I'm in a certain world that I live in, which gives me a certain perspective or perspectives, and then from that perspective, I look at all kinds of worlds, and then what counts as possible and impossible depends on the perspective that you inhabit. So I don't think that here is a world that is impossible. What I want to say is that here is a world, and from this perspective, I think that is impossible, even though from another perspective, that is possible.
Okay, so it sounds like worlds are not just possible or impossible, the way things are not just legal or illegal. Sort of something can be legal here in the U.S. but illegal in Australia. I'm still a little worried. So given the laws here in the actual world, are there any worlds that are possible according to those laws, even if the actual world isn't?
Yeah, so if the world, what happens at the world may be slightly different from what happens here, but nevertheless, what happens there is just still within the laws of our world, then that counts as possible because what happens there does not violate the laws of our world. So from our perspective, that counts as possible.
Should I feel unlucky that I live in one of the impossible worlds rather than in one of the possible ones then?
Well, I don't know whether that we are lucky or unlucky. That's, I think, depends on the perspective. I think that I do think that we are lucky that we live in an impossible world, but that's, I think, personal taste, I think.
Yeah. I know that one of the worries that people have about impossibility is the worry that sort of, you know, all bets are off. Right, anything goes. If you're allowing impossibility, if you're allowing the laws of physics or any kind of the laws of logic, any kinds of laws to be violated now and again, well, what can you know? What can you predict? Anything can go. Is that right, or is that kind of an overreaction? Is that too strong a worry?
So a lot of people do think that a world like that is impossible, and a lot of people do think that that's the paradigmatic impossible world. I do recognize that that's maybe impossible, but I reject the view that that is impossible because there may be a law which allows you to be like that. And as a matter of fact, there is the most venerable system of logic called classical logic, which I think most logicians do believe in. According to that, a contradiction entails everything. So a world like that where anything is true better be possible according to classical laws of logic. So I think whether that's counted as possible or impossible, I think that depends on the laws.
But if everything is true, how do I distinguish between sort of the stuff that I'm allowed to assert and believe and the stuff that I'm not allowed to assert and believe? Like, I usually think there's a kind of interesting difference between the sky is blue and down is up. But if they're both just equally true and equally false, isn't that a disaster?
Well, I think it's really weird. It's a very strange world, but I don't think that's impossible. It's just that it's a bit hard to have a life in that kind of world. That's probably true, but that does not make it impossible.
Yeah, I just don't want to buy a house there. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about impossible worlds with Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University.
Should we spend more time pondering the impossible? Would it make us more open-minded? Or would we just lose our grip on reality?
Impossibility, imagination, and improvement. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. What happens if it's yes and it's no? Is that just impossible? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Koji Tanaka from the Australian National University, and we're thinking about impossible worlds.
Koji, all of this is really fun to think about, but is it just fun, or are there some real-life benefits from thinking about impossible worlds?
So I think the answer is yes. May not be impossibility as such, but thinking through impossibility and what does what the impossibility means, I think that have a real life benefit. So I think what seems to happen in the world right now is that we are politically completely polarized, and we just can't even have a debate about anything because everyone is essentially asserting their value. But one way to argue against someone else's view is to say that if your view were right, then all of this absurdity happens, or all of this impossibility happens. So you might think that if your view of impossibility is right, then all of this impossibility must be the case as well. But in order to do that, you can't just treat... when you say... if your view of impossibility were true, you can't just assert that as an impossibility claim if you want me to come along with you. Because if you just say that, oh, that's just impossible, I'm not going to talk to you about it, which is what happens now. But what you have to be able to do is that, okay, there might be something interesting about this, meaning that there might be some possibility involved in it. It's just that when you come down to it, there's impossibility involved. What that means is that you can't just say that your view is impossible from the beginning. So I think that according to my view, what counts as possible and impossible is completely relativized. It's completely contingent on our situation. So you have to be able to understand where you are coming from, meaning that you can't simply say that your view is impossible. Use a redescription of your view as a claim that is impossible. You have to somehow take that as somehow impossible. Then you can derive impossibility. Then that's the way you can at least have a dialogue. So I think thinking through impossibility is very important.
So this feels related to some debates that I've heard philosophers have about how do you reason from a supposition. So there's this one kind of view that if a supposition is impossible, you just can't kind of reason within it. You just, once you suppose an impossibility, okay, everything's true, we're done. And it sounds like you think that's kind of not very politically helpful, but maybe not also very philosophically helpful. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so I think it is very common for philosophers, but also this is very common in mathematics to say that if something were the case, then you can derive all of this absurdity, or if you interpret absurdity to be impossibility. What seems to be happening there is that when you say if something were the case, that's not being asserted as impossibility to start with. What is impossible is what's being derived from that supposition. So what counts as possible and impossible has to be contingent on the context in which that claim is being asserted.
So I want to think more about this argument form too. So this is also kind of a useful mathematical argument form. So I suppose something, I don't know whether it's possible. I reason to a contradiction and I say, oh, it must not have been possible because the stuff I could derive from it was impossible. Do you think that that's a good way of argument, or should we revise our practices so the mathematicians don't argue in that way anymore?
No, I think that is a good argument form. And I think we do that all the time. But I think to think that kind of argument form cannot get off the ground, I think that is a mistake, because that's where all you got is simply to assert our values. So we say, this is my value, and whatever else the value that you want to assert, that's got to be impossible. So if you want to have a dialogue, at least we have to be able to treat someone's claim to be somehow possible in the way that when you have a supposition and say, I suppose this were the case, then you shouldn't be asserting that as impossible to start with. You should be deriving impossibility. As a result of that, in that context, you can then say, oh, actually, my assumption got to be impossible.
So it sounds like we've got two benefits on the table from thinking about impossible worlds and taking them seriously and trying to kind of dive into them. One is it's sort of good for debate. It's good for exchange. Another is maybe there's some little nuggets of gold amid all of the thing you just consider to be nonsense. But maybe we could add a third. There's a narratologist named Marie-Laure Ryan, and she has this lovely line about impossible fictions. She says they make us smarter, right? These impossible, like diving into an impossible world can make us smarter. We have to, you know, get those cogs and gears turning to figure out, well, exactly how is this world impossible? And what kind of other sense could it make? Do you think that makes sense too, Koji, that there could be something about our engagement with impossible worlds that's a kind of good exercise for the brain?
Yeah, I do think so. Because you do have to stretch your imagination, kind of, I guess, to the limit, so to speak. Because what you are trying to imagine is a situation or maybe a story where it just does not cohere with what you ought to be doing or what you ought to be thinking about. So to go beyond that, I'm not sure that whether I'm good at doing it, but I think to go beyond that, I think is a really good intellectual exercise.
So Koji, way back at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that it was a Buddhist text that first got you interested in impossibility and impossible worlds. Can you tell us more about that text and what it said?
So the text is called Muramajima Kakarika, and the author is Nagarjuna. And he was considered to be, I guess, the first or second century Buddhist philosopher in India. And there's a famous, I guess it's not so that, I'm not sure that the particular passage as such, but he's famous for the kind of argumentation that he seems to be putting forward. So the way that he argues is that he has four assumptions and say the world could be either this, 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 or that. And what he does is that none of the above, or none of them is the case. Now, there is a debate as to whether he is deriving a conclusion after rejecting all four, but some people do think that he is deriving a conclusion. What that means is that the conclusion has to be logically possible. But that conclusion has to be impossible in terms of how the reality must be. So that's how I started thinking about impossibility.
So he thinks there are four possibilities. They're the only four possibilities, and none of them are true. What are the four possibilities?
So the four possibilities is that it is the case. And so he has he goes through different topics and refute all four. But the forms of those four possibilities are that it is this, or for example, everything is caused by self, for example, or everything is caused by something else. And then the third one looks like a conjunction of the two. Everything is caused by self and caused by something else. And the fourth one is basically neither. And he goes through different topics. So I mentioned the example of causation. He goes through different examples to show that none of them are wholes.
That's so interesting. It reminds me of Zeno's paradoxes, to mention those again. So Zeno, you know, one of Zeno's paradoxes is you can't get to the next town because you have to do that, you have to go halfway first, and to get to there, you have to go a quarter of the way first, and to get to there, right? And so that's one. He's also got an arrow paradox where how can an arrow move? After all, it's stationary at any given moment. And the beauty of these two paradoxes is you can solve the arrow as long as there is no such thing as a smallest unit of time. And you can solve the bisection, the first one I talked about, if there is a smallest unit of time. And so this is just, I mean, it's a mind-blowingly brilliant way of basically reminding us we're living in an impossible world. And I'm looking at Ray while I'm saying this because I want you to convince Ray, Koji, we really are living in an impossible world. Can you do it?
can I convince Ray of anything? That's a hard question to answer, I think.
Do you have any more arguments to throw at us to convince skeptics that we really are, the world we're living in right now, the real world, is in fact impossible?
Well, I'm not sure that whether I have a knockdown argument, but think of a possibility where whatever the laws that you think are operating in our world, you are wrong about that. So that means that you should be able to think about what our world is like, but slightly different laws. Now, then you might think that, okay, I may have to accept that the world we live in maybe paraconsistent, where no contradictions enters everything, or something of that kind. Now, and if you can accept that, then I think you should be able to accept that, okay, maybe our world is impossible.
Well, Koji, it has been impossibly great talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was my pleasure to be here.
Our guest has been Koji Tanaka, ARC Future Fellow at the Australian National University and author of Logically Impossible Worlds. So, Ray, did Koji convince you?
Well, I'm not totally convinced that the actual world is an impossible world, but I think it's at least possible that it is.
Touché. We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and check out our library of nearly 600 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, the impossibly fast thoughts of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I don't know about impossible world, but we probably live in a possible world deemed, in fact, the best of all possible worlds by Gottfried Leibniz in the wake of coining the word theodicy, meaning justice for God. Give God a break regarding creation. I mean, come on, can you do better? And this is an offshoot of Leibniz's monadology, a kind of precursor to quantum physics. Monads are the immaterial building blocks of everything, from sunlight to dinosaurs. They're like metaphysical Legos in that they can only be put together per instructions intuited by fellow monads. You can't turn a Lego Star Wars kit into a Lego Godzilla. And monads that make humans don't make chairs. They all follow different rules which exist in the mind of God, the first monad. There's no free will, really, but God is perfect, and so would anything he slaps together. Therefore, this is the best of all possible worlds. Now, Leibniz may have been the smartest man who ever lived. He invented the world's first calculator and calculus, for crying out loud. Well, so did Isaac Newton at pretty much the same time. Newton claimed that Leibniz stole calculus from him. This led to all kinds of trouble for Leibniz, since Newton was firmly embedded on the smartest guy in the world throne and had the might of England behind his every mutter. Or however he issued opinions, Newton was a prickly, paranoid, defensive, vindictive fellow. Not to put too fine a point on it, Leibniz had a sunnier disposition. But he's also kind of a suck-up, it seems, looking for people to underwrite his output, which was staggering and diverse. Half of his writing has yet to be cataloged. He supported himself for years by being a kind of smart guy for hire. He advised the Elector of Maine, second in charge of the Holy Roman Empire during the Thirty Years' War, to encourage France to invade Egypt so they won't pick fights with German-speaking nations. Didn't happen, but Napoleon picked up on that a little later on, so you can see how Leibniz might have made enemies. Being the smartest guy around, his words had the ring of authority, which, when removed from the authoritarian ring, that is, from the Elector of Maine's past, subjected him to toxic negativity, as the kids say. But he remained cheerful, personable, throw out the opinion, move on to the next. A history of the Habsburgs, perhaps, or a way to make ships sail faster. Maybe I could be a surgeon. Can't be that hard to learn. He never had a magnum opus, though. Most of his writings came in spurts and dabs, but he was clear and plain-spoken. As if his life wasn't amazing enough, he would exaggerate his resume. So he came to have a reputation as a not entirely trustworthy person. He was also somewhat obsequious, or if you prefer, charming and well-mannered, around those who might give him money. He also became out of touch with the times, dressing in the court fashion of a Paris 30 years gone, all of which may explain the disdain many had in the wake of Newton's accusations of Leibniz's notion that this is the best of all possible worlds. Voltaire drew Leibniz's Pangloss in Candide, the optimist who winds up feeling okay about rotting from syphilis because syphilis may have been brought to Europe by Columbus, but he also brought us chocolate. Though Leibniz ended his days on the outs, he lived by his wits and was mainly rewarded. But if Voltaire is right, it might not be the best world for everybody, or for us in general, or even me in particular. What with bad knees and stiff necks, not to mention serial killers and crypto, is pretty slim pickings in the perfect world department, but come on, let it go. All possibilities are here, in a whirl of becoming. This isn't a utopia, but it is a playland of God's devising, extrapolated from math and speculation. Maybe Leibniz is talking about monads themselves, for whom the world is always perfect, really, like a model kit fully assembled with all the parts still there. And who's got the instruction booklet? Monads, man. I tell you, they got it made. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I know this is going to be hard to believe, Doctor, but for once I mean you no harm. Like Alice, I try to believe three impossible things before breakfast.